Wait. Before we start, just want to make sure we're clear here. While this podcast talks about sobriety, mental health, and addiction, it is not meant to replace professional medical advice. Welcome to Sisters in Sobriety.
I'm Kathleen.
And I'm Sonia.
And we're ex-sisters-in-law, brought together in marriage and bonded through our sobriety journey.
Join us as we talk sobriety, addiction, and everything in between. You're in for quite a ride. And our Substack is buzzing with amazing content, from creative mocktail recipes to insightful courses and reflective exercises. There is something for everyone. Don't miss out. It's a great way to add some extra joy and depth to your journey. Check it out. Today, we are thrilled to welcome Whitney Combs to Sisters in Sobriety. Whitney is a nationally board-certified health and wellness coach with a unique focus on addiction recovery. After achieving sobriety in 2017, she transitioned from her career as a physician's assistant to pursue her passion for helping women create lives free from alcohol. With a deep understanding of the complexities of addiction and a background in medicine, Whitney brings a holistic and compassionate approach to her coaching practice.
One of the hallmarks of her work is her philosophy of compassionate accountability. Whitney's approach blends empathy with actionable steps, guiding her clients to take ownership of their recovery journey while extending grace to themselves.
Through her programs, Whitney helps women navigate sobriety with confidence, whether they're in the early stages of recovery or looking to deepen their sense of purpose and well-being.
So today, we're going to be diving into the ways Whitney's approach is transforming how people think about recovery and healing. Whitney, we are so excited to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here. I appreciate the offer to come and chat about this. It's something that's so near and dear to my heart, and I could talk about recovery all day long. So this is a lot of fun for me.
So could we, but we promise to not go all day. But can you start with sharing your personal journey towards sobriety and what inspired you to make that change?
Absolutely. You know, I am one of those people who always had a pretty dysfunctional relationship with alcohol. I never knew if I was going to have 2 or 10 and didn't really have an off switch most of the time. Mm-hmm. And that started really in college. A lot of binge drinking, a lot of blacking out, and a lot of thinking it was normal, yeah. You know, just really because it was part of the culture of the people that I was surrounded with. Everybody drank heavily. Everybody, you know, I thought everybody blacked out. I think now looking back, I think that's not the truth, but I just assumed that my experience was the common experience. So fast forward to probably my 30s, I was still doing a lot of social drinking, a lot of binge drinking on the weekends, but things started to get a little more intense. And then right at the end of my 30s, so as I was turning 40, in 2016, things really just went off the rails. And I never could really pinpoint. It was partially, I was working a job that was asking more of me than I was capable of giving. I was raising 4 young children in a blended family, which was very challenging. And so some combination of these things just threw my drinking off the rails. And I went from pretty much weekend binging to daily drinking to really manage the stress of life. I didn't realize that's what I was doing at the time, but in retrospect, I see that I was really just drinking at all of the stress I was experiencing. And so 2016 was a nightmare. And many, many, many times over the course of 2016, I tried to moderate initially and then started trying to stop because it just wasn't. It wasn't serving me. It wasn't working. And then it was a pretty ordinary day of drinking that actually, I say, brought me to my knees. My husband, on January 1st, I was recovering from a cold. We hadn't gone out New Year's Eve because I was under the weather. My husband took all the kids to the pool because you can do that in Florida in January. So they all went to the pool, giving me some time to rest and recuperate, recover. And instead of doing that, I sat on the back porch and drank 2 bottles of wine. And I woke up the next morning just as they say, kind of sick and tired of being so sick and tired. I recognized, well, for whatever reason, I recognized in that moment something had to change. I had to really figure this thing out, or I was going to continue to sit on the back porch and drink two bottles of wine mm-hmm. instead of living my life. So I searched yoga and recovery online because I was doing a yoga teacher training at the time, and I was really doing a lot of yoga, still do, and found Holly Whitaker, who wrote Quit Like a Woman. And at the time she was running a group coaching program called Hip Sobriety. And so I joined that 8-week container and didn't drink again. So we went through, you know, all of her coaching philosophy. I fell in love with her philosophy around recovery, just fell in love with her as a human being, and kept in touch with her after that program, and really had decided I wanted to do some coaching. So she helped me along in that arena. And then when she started Tempest, which was a company, a health tech startup that was geared toward alcohol education and recovery, when she started that, she brought me on as her third employee to build out their coaching program. And so I spent many years at Tempest building their coaching program, coaching women within that program, and just really loving having the ability to influence and make so many lives better, or lead so many people toward better lives.
So Whitney, we know now, like, your frame of reference is that Tempest, Quit Like a Woman. How do you define a life without alcohol? What does that mean to you? Does that mean like a life without substances? Does that mean a life full of yoga? What does it mean to you?
What a great question. I think it very basically means not using something to numb out from life, mm-hmm. to numb out from stress. And I think it also for me means bringing supportive practices into my life. You know, I really like to look at this as an additive process where we're bringing in meditation, journaling, yoga, living room dance parties, mm-hmm. lots of hot tea, all these things. We're bringing them into our lives so that we don't need to escape our experience. And that's what alcohol helps us to do, is really escape ourselves. And so I think that living an alcohol-free life means really just building this life that I don't need to escape from.
Yeah, I love that. That's what it means to me too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've recently spoke about that with some clients of mine because they were questioning, like, do you think I have a problem with alcohol? And I was like, well, are you using it to cope from the stresses of your life? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, uh-huh. And ding, ding. Yeah. But I think a lot of people don't think that, right? They're like, oh, well, that's what it's used for. It's used to relax from the stresses of life. And it's like, wait a second.
Yes. Yeah. Well, we're conditioned for that, right? Yeah. I mean, everywhere we look, people are using alcohol to deal with the stress of life. I kind of joke, I'm a big Downton Abbey fan. Like, I have watched the whole...
Me too.
The whole series, like yeah. 8 times. I mean, like, it's a sickness. But that's how I cope with life. That's how I come out right now.
Yeah. I swear I was going through a really difficult time, and I binge watched Bridgerton.
Oh,
and it reset my
brain. Yes. And I've watched Bridgerton too. It's not as bad with the alcohol as Downton Abbey is.
No.
Like, in Downton Abbey, every time something stressful happens, people are reaching for that decanter, that crystal decanter of whiskey or whatever's in it. And it's just interesting because I think we're just inundated with these messages.
For sure. It's so normalized.
Yes,
I feel like mom culture too. Like, you know, time to grab the bottle of wine, girls. It's been a stressful day with the kids. It's like, it's totally normalized.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mommy juice. Yep.
Yeah, so absolutely. This sort of relates to my next question, actually, is like, how has your perspective on alcohol and its role in society evolved since your journey into sobriety?
Oh, yeah. I didn't think much about it when I was drinking. Mm-hmm. You know, there was no reason to think about it. And so certainly in recovery, my core belief is that alcohol is not evil. Mm-hmm. I don't demonize alcohol in our house. I have teenagers. And my fear is that if I tell them, and I do tell them the truth, you know, I tell them it's dangerous. It's a toxic substance. It's a poison. It's addictive. And you've got to be careful. And I know you're going to experiment with it. You're not a bad person for doing that. And, you know, we just need to help you figure out how to do that responsibly. And so I think initially in recovery, I was very, I don't know, maybe self-righteous is the right word. And, you know, I am living a clean life and I am sort of holier than thou kind of attitude. And I've come down from that and kind of come to this place where everybody has to figure out their own relationship. There's no right way to do this. Well, there's no right way to do recovery, but there's also no right way to kind of walk through the world. And if you're using alcohol responsibly and you're not using it to cope with life, and, you know, then I don't really see a problem with it. As long as people know, like, I'm so grateful for this Surgeon General thing, because now people know it's a poison. Now people know it causes cancers, and they can do, you know, we do all kinds of things that are bad for us. So if they can do it with their eyes wide open, that feels okay.
Kathleen, do you know about the American Surgeon General wanting
I
to put?
Do. Yeah. I do. Yes. Yeah. And I mean, in Canada, I guess it was like maybe 18 months ago, maybe less, they basically came out and said, there's no amount of alcohol that's safe. So that was a step for us. But we actually, in the province I live in, I feel took a step back because we could not buy alcohol in grocery stores or convenience stores. Yeah. And then all of a sudden they expanded. So on one hand, they're saying no amount is safe. And then on the other hand, they're like, here, have more access to
Let's make it more accessible.
Yeah. So I think it's great that in the US they were proposing. Yeah. Are they doing it or just proposing it?
I think it's just proposing it at this point. Yeah.
Okay.
But that's a big deal.
It is a big deal. It is.
Yeah. I don't know how many people sent me that newspaper clip or everybody was like, look at this. And I'm like, yes, I've known this for years, people.
Yeah. So I'm sure they asked Kathleen this too, as a therapist, but how do you maintain your own well-being while supporting others in recovery?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's challenging, right? It's hard to give so much of yourself emotionally. And I do that with my clients. I can't not do that. Then to maintain your own sense of self and your own recovery. And so I have lots of practices that I'm pretty superstitious about. I have my non-negotiables, the things that I know I have to do every day or every week to stay the course. Mm-hmm. And so I do those things. And for me, that's a meditation and a journaling practice. It's a movement practice. And it's kind of keeping my head in the game with either creative practices or some kind of cognitive endeavor. And by that, I just mean reading or listening to podcasts, you know, just keeping myself up to speed on things. But if I don't do those things, then I'm not okay. And if I'm not okay, I can't show up for my clients. And so there's my motivation, right? Is to be able to show up for people. I have to first show up for myself.
Yeah. I feel the same way as a therapist. I have to have those practices. Mm-hmm. However, it's interesting because what you just said, Whitney, is like, for me to show up for other people, I have to show up for myself. I feel like that could be universal.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
100%.
Not just for people in the healing profession, just for anyone that has anyone else in their life actually.
Right. That's depending on them. Yeah. Yes. Yes. We need this message, I think, particularly for mothers.
Yeah.
It's an important message.
So what motivated your transition from a physician's assistant to a health and wellness coach? Like, I know you said, you used a phrase, the job was asking more of you than you could give. Mm-hmm. I think you said, was it that reason?
It was. I had practiced clinically for years in neurology and transitioned to PA education because I was working really long hours in a hospital and I had a young kid. at the time, just one. So I transitioned to education thinking that would be, it would be a an easier schedule. And it was, and I loved teaching, loved teaching. It was just, I came alive in the classroom and absolutely loved it. But as time went on, the university very understandably wanted me to go back to part-time clinical work to stay relevant in the clinical field and to start to research with the intention of publishing. Again, totally understandable, absolutely not where my heart was.
Right.
That was not what I wanted to be doing. And I wanted to be helping people move along in life. And I was doing that with my students too. You know, it wasn't around alcohol, but it was helping people to build good study skills, build good habits, build a life that they can enjoy as physician assistants. So it was really that, just not being able to kind of keep up with the expectations, I think, that really encouraged me to move away. And I left that job, I think, 3 months before I got sober. So the alcohol had something to do with it. At the time, I didn't identify that, but I knew that I couldn't stop drinking if I was going to continue that job.
Yeah, that's how I felt too about my job. There's something about the stress level or doing something you're not passionate about that the drinking allows you to do longer than you would be able to otherwise. It's, I always say that people think, oh, like all their relationships are going to get better when they quit drinking. But I found with some of them, it's like, oh, I have no patience for you when I'm sober. Like, it's the same thing with a job too. It's like, oh, when I'm sober, this is unacceptable. Winnie, how did your medical background influence your approach to coaching clients in recovery?
You know, I think I come at this from, I think, a kind of a scientific perspective. I love the physiology behind, you know, what alcohol does to our bodies and, you know, drinking and dopamine, you know, how our brains react to dopamine, all of this. So I think my medical background allows me to understand those things, I think, pretty quickly, which is nice. And I also learned as a physician assistant how to connect with people around things that were troubling them. Because I had to, you know, my patients, when I was practicing, most of them had seizure disorders. And there was a lot of concomitant depression and anxiety to go along with that, understandably. And so I learned in that position how to kind of meet people where they were and help them to, you know, just continue to move forward despite this diagnosis. And so I think that that's kind of what I do now, is I meet people where they are and help them to move forward into a higher level of functioning.
What challenges, Whitney, did you face during your own recovery, and how have they shaped your coaching?
I have had one night of drinking since I got sober on January 2nd of 2017. It was right before the pandemic, right before the world shut down. I had been on a trip with my daughter, my youngest daughter, to see a girlfriend. Low stress trip. Not, you know, shouldn't have been any big deal, except that I was traveling alone with, I guess Emmy was probably 7 at the time. On the plane home, for whatever reason, they came by and offered drinks. And I thought, wine would be nice. And I drank and drank again and drank, you know, I drank that whole trip home on the plane. And had to call my husband to come pick us up, and woke up the next day with all the shame and the regrets and the guilt and feeling awful, just physically awful. But I think that that experience has helped me to really understand folks who are in that cycle of, you know, stopping and then slipping back into old habits, of stopping and then slipping back in, and recognizing that I had to give myself grace for that slip. It had to be nothing more than information. You know, it couldn't be that I was broken and defective. That was not what I believed. It was just information that if I could go back, look at what happened, figure out how to keep that from happening again, and then move forward from that place, it was okay. That's one thing I help folks do, is to really just recontextualize those slips as something that is just data. I mean, I think Annie Grace calls them data points. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so the slips are just information.
We say that all the time.
All the time.
I think all the time. And I think it's true. And I'm so like, I love to hear you say that like it happened to you. Mm-hmm. That it wasn't like, you know, it happened. You felt the shame the next day and you were like, okay, this is just data. And what did you learn from that? I'm curious, what was the data for you that you learned from that?
Yeah, I mean, I do think just very, very superficially, I learned to be careful on airplanes and in airports. Mm-hmm. And
interesting.
You know, yeah. Really triggering places for a lot of people, like very, very triggering. And so I don't think I have traveled alone since. I think I could at this point, but for a little while I was kind of like, you know, I need a buddy. I need my ride or die for a little bit. And I think too, just recognizing that good stress is still stress.
Yes.
So I've had all this, you know, fun stuff happen. I'm visiting my best friend. I was with my daughter. I was, you know, everything was kind of fun and good. And I drank. And so I have to recognize that it wasn't negative stuff that got me there. It was the happy, good stuff. And it kind of caught me off guard. Mm-hmm. So it just, I think too, just kind of helps me to keep my guard up when my nervous system is ratcheted for any reason.
Mm-hmm. I was talking to someone last week and they said what surprised them the most was when they were in recovery and something positive would happen, that was a trigger, like the celebration was a trigger for drinking. And I totally understood that. Like, I think for me, everything was a trigger. So like good, bad, anything in between, but it makes sense. Like weddings, things that you want to celebrate your birthday, it can definitely be a trigger.
Yeah. And again, we're conditioned to that. We see it all over the media. We see it, you know, that is what people are doing. People are happy and drinking because they're happy. And we're supposed to do that. It's maddening.
Mm-hmm. It is maddening. There are two things I regret in my recovery. And one is that I never got to go to rehab because it seems like it would be kind of fun. And I have never had a slip. And so it's almost scarier to not have had a slip because I don't know what it would look like now, almost 8 years later. And I think sometimes it does give you this feeling of like you're not relatable because, you know, most people have a slip. But I always tell people, like, I quit every day for 10 years and then drank every day. So did have I had 1,000 slips. And so when I did finally quit, it was like, look, I've tried this before and it hasn't worked. So now we talk, you know, about different types of programs like 12-step and like SMART and Recovery Dharma. Okay. But can you discuss the role of holistic approaches in your coaching practice?
Yeah. You know, when I think about holistic coaching, I just really think about including the whole mind, body, and spirit. And I think that's so important. You know, addiction, alcohol use disorder, however you want to talk about it, touches every area of our lives.
Did you know your actual age might not be the same as your biological age? That's right. It's not just about your birth date. Your body could be older or younger than you think. That's where True Diagnostic comes in. With their True Age test, you can discover your true biological age, plus get insights into things like your risk for heart disease, Alzheimer's, and even early mortality. And the best part? It's all done from the comfort of your own home. No prescriptions, no lab visits, just a simple test sent right to your door. By tracking your biological age, you can actually see how the changes you make, whether it's to your exercise, diet, or sleep, affect your health over time. It's about taking actionable steps to improve your well-being. Oh, and if you are wondering about high-profile people taking it seriously, Brian Johnson, the guy who's working on reversing aging, and I watched his documentary on Netflix, uses True Diagnostic to track his progress. Ready to find out your biological age? Right now, our listeners can get 20% off their entire order at truediagnostic.com by using the code CIS2025 at checkout. That's True Diagnostic, TRUDIAGNOSTIC.com. Just use the code SIS2025 to save 20%. Plus, if you subscribe, you'll get an additional 20% off the 50% discount. Discover your true age today.
It touches our relationships. It touches our environment and our career. It touches our body. It touches our spirit and our mind. And so I think that a recovery plan has to really touch all of those things too. And so I use something that I call, that was developed really by a gentleman named John DePuy and then made more accessible by Holly. But we use a recovery map that basically splits a person's life into four quadrants: my mind, my body, my people, and my world. And we look for practices in each of those areas to support recovery. And it's nice to kind of organize it in that way, because then you can look at this map and you can kind of see where the holes are. You know, maybe I'm not doing enough in this mind category to feed my spirit, to feed my mind, or maybe it's, you know, a body category. I'm not doing enough movement, or I'm not hydrating like I could be. So it lets you kind of see where the holes are, which is really nice. But I just think it's so important to really address the whole organism, because again, you know, the alcohol touched everything. So we need to touch everything as we're recovering.
Mm-hmm. We're going to switch gears a little bit, Whitney. Yeah. And we want to talk about compassionate accountability. And so how do you define that, and why is it important in the recovery process?
I don't have a succinct definition of compassionate accountability. It is more of a kind of a philosophy that I live by and I work by. It's this idea of combining the need to be committed, the need to have some discipline and practices, with the ability to give ourselves some space and to give ourselves some grace. Mm-hmm. And so pulling those things together, they can feel they're in opposition, but I don't think they are in practice, because I think we can set compassionate goals for ourselves. We can, you know, instead of setting this goal of like, I'm going to get on the Peloton for 45 minutes a day, 5 days a week into, you know, eternity. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, that's not compassionate to yourself, unless that's where you are, unless you can do that easily. But setting goals that really just honor where you are and who you are. For me, it's like, no, I need to get on the bike for 20 minutes, 3 days a week, because that's what I'm capable of doing without making myself insane. So I think it's just that idea of combining the more disciplined, committed approach with this ability to just really meet yourself where you are, let yourself just be who you are, and let that, you know, kind of come through in your recovery, if that makes sense.
It does.
It does. I met with my friend last week and she's doing the Whoop band.
Oh yeah.
You know, and it tells you like you need a rest day, or it will tell you like your body isn't recovered enough for weight. So I found that really interesting, because that's the opposite of, we've always been in this beast mode of working out, which I hate. And partly why I hate the Peloton is because it's so like, let's do it. And I'm like, I don't want to do it. Like, but it's interesting. I think that is true of the Aura band and the Whoop, I think, are starting to give data on where your body is at, and that you do need like rest and you need different things on different days. And even if you're ignoring what your body is telling you, I think it'll tell you.
That is fascinating. And
talk
about something that's meeting you where you are.
Yeah. I was surprised. Amazing.
That is amazing. I love health technology.
I do too. Yeah.
I would have it all.
Me too. I'm dangerous in that way. I would just wear it and I would follow it, you know, meticulously and make myself, you know, nuts trying to. I'm impressed.
Yeah. So what inspired you to develop that approach in your coaching practice, that balance of you know, listening to your body and who you are, and then also balancing that with accountability and practices.
Yeah. You know, I owe so much of how I show up as a coach to Holly and to her approach to recovery. And she really showed me that it is imperative that we come to this with a kindness and a gentleness for ourselves, that we can't, I tried all my life to beat myself into submission. I tried my whole life to berate myself and belittle myself and, you know, just make myself do things. And it didn't work. And it didn't work with alcohol either. I could tell myself I was a piece of garbage for drinking again, but that didn't do any good. And so through Holly's program, really came to understand that I had to treat myself like I would treat my child or a good friend. And if I didn't do that, this thing wasn't going to stick. Because, you know, I say to clients a lot, fear is a fickle motivator. And it worked for a minute, and then it stops working. But if you can come to this really with compassion for yourself and with some excitement for what's going to come from, you know, from letting go of alcohol and from really digging in and learning who you are again, it's a game changer. It's an absolute game changer.
So how is this approach different than traditional accountability used in addiction recovery, or is it?
I think it probably depends on who you talk to. Right. I think, and especially now, there are so many more people out there who are really recognizing that the importance of the compassion component. I think for a long time, we have thought that alcohol use disorder was a moral defect, that it was a choice, that people, you know, were making a choice to drink and to not get sober. And I think as we start to untangle some of those myths, really, that the compassionate piece has come back in. Now, I will say that I think, you know, there are, and I love 12-step programs. I think they're absolutely fantastic. They work for the people they work for. They did not work for me. It was not the approach I could take. And a lot of that was because of some of the underlying philosophy there is you're broken, you're deficient, and you need to be fixed. And I kind of come at this from a, like, I'm not broken. I told myself my whole life I was broken and that didn't do any good. I'm not broken. I don't need to be fixed. I need to be guided. I need to be supported. I need to be held and loved. And I just think that that's the only way that I was going to get sober. The absolute only way I was going to get sober. I was not going to do it by believing that I was broken.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. I agree exactly with what you said about the 12th step. It, for the people that it works for, it works.
Yes.
But it doesn't work for everyone. We really like to talk about practical strategies here because I have trouble understanding like vague concepts. So what strategies can you use to balance compassion and accountability?
I think a lot of it is figuring out where you are in a given moment and allowing yourself, like knowing yourself well enough to know kind of how you're showing up in a given space. And so that takes some self-inquiry, right? And so that's a strategy, I think, is to really kind of dig in and to understand where you are and how you're showing up. And then I think it's meeting yourself in that place rather than saying, you know, here are the things that I have to get done. Here are, you know, I've been told I have to meditate. I have to move my body. Instead, it's this idea of looking inward, figuring out where you are in a given moment, and then figuring out kind of using that strategy of what do I need right now? And figuring out what you actually need in a given moment rather than what you should be doing. So that self-inquiry and just meeting yourself where you are really the biggest pieces of that for me.
Yeah, we've talked about the like shoulding yourself. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. My therapist tells me not to should on myself.
Yeah, I say that to my clients too. I'm like, yeah. Don't should on yourself. Yeah, exactly. When looking at your coaching practice, how do you evaluate a client's readiness for change when they begin with you?
I ask them.
Yeah,
it's definitely.
Are you definitely wanting to change or are you
right,
not?
Right. Because we can't do this for anybody but ourselves. You know, you can feel ready to change for someone else, but again, it's fickle. Like it just doesn't last. And so when I do initial discovery calls, I'm listening for that readiness talk. You know, I'm sick and tired of feeling this way. I am committed to moving forward to doing something different. And then I have direct questions in my intake that are, you know, how motivated are you? How much time are you planning? You know, do you anticipate being able to spend on your recovery? Just very direct questions. And, you know, when people are unmotivated, that's a conversation. That's just a discussion that we need to have, because there's no reason to put time, money, energy into this thing if you're not willing to explore the possibility of change. I don't think you have to come to it like, I'm definitely done. I'm definitely not ever drinking again, because I definitely have clients who come in and are still trying to kind of evaluate how they want alcohol to show up in their lives. And that's great. But I think unless you're willing to make some changes and unless you're willing to invest your time and energy into that, wait.
The therapist, I know this, like that we, no client that comes in to see me is the same. So how do you tailor your coaching to meet the needs of each client?
That just starts with listening. Mm-hmm. Really taking the time to let the client talk. And let the client, you know what we need to heal. I truly believe that each of us knows deep inside somewhere what we need. And so my job is to listen to what the client needs. And, you know, again, I keep saying this 1,000 times this morning, but meeting them where they are. And that takes some time to kind of figure out where they are. But I think it's easy to come to this with kind of this prescriptive attitude of you need to drink hot lemon water every morning and meditate for 10 minutes and do your gratitudes. But that doesn't work for everyone. Mm-hmm. And so if I don't take the time to just hear what they've tried, what resonates, what they're willing to try, then it's useless. So it is all about listening in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So onto more practical strategies, how do you help clients navigate social situations where alcohol is present?
I have an acronym that I use for that, and it's DEAR.
D-E-A-R. Love an acronym.
You love an acronym. Okay, here you go. So the D is dream big, and that is a step of really visualizing the event. And I encourage people to visualize from the moment that they're getting dressed and ready without a cocktail, without pre-partying, all the way through the event, enjoying themselves, having fun, laughing, talking, being engaged and engaging, all the way up to the next morning after they go through the night sober and wake up feeling clear-headed and proud. So that's the D. That's the dream big. Dream big. The E is exit strategy. I always, always, always have a plan to get the heck out of Dodge. If that means having my Uber app, you know, updated with my latest credit card information, whatever that means, I have a way to get out. And if I can't like physically leave a situation, I am real clear with folks that they need to not feel trapped. So you can always go to the bathroom, lock yourself in there and do some breathing, or phone a friend or post on an online forum, you know, somehow get out of the situation. And then the A is alternate beverage, always having something in your hand when you're socializing, because it's so much easier to move or to to move through without people asking you constantly what you want to drink. You're like, I don't need anything. I've got it in my hand. So I'm there. And I'm the queen of mocktails, love mocktails. And then the R is reward. So having a reward set up for yourself once you have moved through this event sober, I think is key. And that can be anything. I mean, it can be as grandiose as going, you know, having a spa day the next day, if you're getting through mm-hmm. something big and hard, or it can be as simple as queuing up your favorite movie on Netflix and having some clean pajamas laid out and a square of dark chocolate. And that can be your reward, but something you look forward to. So mm-hmm. that is how I guide people through social events.
I love those examples, and I love that acronym. I think it's great. I think it's so easy to remember, and it's fantastic. Do you incorporate self-care practices into your coaching recommendations for people?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So as part of that whole recovery map, I think there's self-care that happens in every area. You know, so in my mind, we're nourishing our mind and body. That's however you're doing that. That's self-care. Mm-hmm. And you're nourishing relationships. That's self-care too, or setting boundaries, right? So the relationships is not just about nourishing things. It's about setting boundaries with people and with yourself. But I think, you know, again, anything that is nourishing to your mind, body, spirit, relationships, environment, like all those things are self-care. And so we definitely incorporate those things into a recovery plan.
Yeah.
Amazing.
So Whitney, for people who are not like you and I, who can just, you know, decide to like change our stressful career to something we're passionate about and focus on recovery, what advice do you have for people managing work stress or, you know, a career they're not passionate about without mm-hmm. alcohol? So if that is one of your triggers, as it was for me, and I think it was for you, then how can you learn to manage that if it's not an option to switch jobs?
Yeah. And that's one of the hardest things, right? I think that and being mother to young kids, because you can't switch out of that either. You can't just turn the stress off of that. So I think those are two really hard things to navigate, but finding a way to start your day slowly and intentionally, I think, is huge. For some people, that means you've got to give up 15 minutes of sleep so that you can get up and have some lemon water and have a little bit of reflection time before you pick up your phone and start checking emails and doing all the things for work. So kind of starting slowly and intentionally. And then having breaks throughout the day. And very often, I will have people literally calendar those. So you put 10 minutes on your calendar once a day, and that is sacred time. And it's just 10 minutes. You know, I mean, most of us can find a way to step away for 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. I think very often you'll kind of think you can't, but when you really look at things, you'll figure out a way to step away for a few minutes and just take advantage of those little breaks. Do some breath work. Maybe squeeze in a meditation, read something inspiring, listen to some music that makes you feel good. You know, whatever you need to do to kind of to refill the well is important, because if we let ourselves just wind up all day long and we're here at the end of the day, the only thing that works is a sledgehammer. And the only sledgehammer we have is alcohol. But if we can play this game of like winding up a little bit and then taking a break and coming back down, winding up a little, taking a break and coming back down, then we're here at the end of the day instead of here. And here, hot tea and hot baths and walks around the block bring you down. So I really do think it's this idea, even in when you're in a stressful job, whether it's raising kids or corporate work, you have to find ways to bring your nervous system down, just to consistently monitor your nervous system. I think that's vitally important.
I think too, if someone is like, they can't necessarily leave their job, even finding new passions or hobbies in sobriety can really help balance that. How do you help clients sort of identify or pursue new passions or hobbies in sobriety?
Oh, try everything. Show up empty and try everything. Yeah. So very often we'll just brainstorm things and I'll throw out ideas and they'll throw out ideas. And when you kind of get into that rhythm of brainstorming, fun stuff comes out of your mouth, you know, things that you would never have thought of. And so that brainstorming atmosphere, I think, is nice, where you're kind of going back and forth and, you know, shooting out ideas. Thinking about what you like to do when you were younger, I think, can be helpful for some people. Now, a lot of us started drinking so young that it's hard to find memories of what we enjoyed before drinking. But I do think that's a way, and kind of looking to children and seeing what they gravitate toward, you know? I mean, even doing something silly like going outside and blowing bubbles can be relaxing and can kind of bring your nervous system down. But I think finding new hobbies and new creative endeavors just takes a lot of experimentation and takes a lot of willingness to try. I have a cabinet that has like watercolors and needle felting and needle point and knitting and, like, I mean, tons of stuff. And I'll go into it every now and then and pull something out. And most of those things haven't stuck, but that's not the point. Yes. The point is to enjoy the trying. And so I try to get people to understand that too. It's like, you don't have to be good at watercolors, but man, it's fun to go buy the supplies and just mess around on a canvas. Like, that's fun. Just enjoy that journey.
I was going to say, it's not necessarily about the destination, right? It's the journey.
Yes. Yeah.
What are your future goals for your coaching practice?
So funny you should ask this, because I was actually just thinking yesterday that I was trying to do a visioning workshop on like visioning 2025 for your business. And I hit a wall, because I can honestly say right now, I do not know. Like, I love doing what I'm doing. I love helping people one-on-one. And at some point, I suspect that I'm going to have to do something a little bit different, but I don't know what it is. I don't know what that's going to look like. And being a solopreneur is really challenging. There are really hard things about it, and figuring out how to market, how to find the people that need guidance. Like, that is challenging. That's really hard. So I have lately kind of gotten bogged down in some minutiae in my business. And so I'm having trouble with the big picture, but I'll get back to you on that.
Yeah, great. Yes. Definitely do. Yeah.
Please do. Thank you so much, Whitney, for being on today. And how can listeners connect with you if they're interested in your services or learning more about your approach?
Absolutely. Instagram is a reasonable way to get in touch with me, Whitney.Combs. On Instagram. And then my website is whitneycombs.com. And my email is whitney@whitneycombs.com. And I love when people connect with me, just letting me know how people are doing, or what your experience is, or, you know, where you are in your journey. Even if there's no intention of ever engaging in any kind of services, I really enjoy talking to people about this. So please do reach out.
Great. Well, thank you all for listening to Sisters in Sobriety, and we will see you next week.
This was Sisters in Sobriety.
Thank you for listening and being with us today.
If you want to learn more about sobriety and meet your community, find us at sistersinsobriety.substack.com.
Are you a sister in sobriety? Then reach out on social media. We'd love to hear from you.
If you're feeling generous, leave us 5 stars and a review, and follow us wherever you listen.
You'll never miss an episode. Until next time.